Welcome back from holiday, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you had a pleasant holiday and are well rested for the second week of my course of lectures on political economy in the light of history. Starting today, I'll be speaking about the First World War, and each day I will move closer to the present, and as I do, the events about which I speak will seem a little more familiar, a little more like the world in which we live. In some very important ways, however, at least for the people of the United States, the events since the first decade of the 20th century all seem modern. Some of the most important institutions that have shaped economic and political life throughout the 20th century were already created before World War I. And most important of all, the ideology of progressivism, which led the American people for the first time to understand the role of government as a very active one. A government that was active was for the first time desired as a normal institution. In the past, people had expected that government would do many things during wartime, but only during wartime. Most Americans believed in the 19th century that government should be limited, that it should not involve itself very much in business or in economic affairs, that it should leave people alone, that it should follow the policy that the French liberals of the 18th century called laissez-faire. Let them do as they want to. Let people alone. Now, that doesn't mean that the Americans were anarchists. They were not. Anarchists were very few, and most of them probably were Europeans who moved to the United States in the late 19th century. But even though Americans did believe in government and they believed that it had some proper tasks to perform, they did not believe that those tasks were many. Still important, government should keep order, it should enforce the laws, it should make sure that people's private property rights were respected and reliable, so that when they made economic arrangements with one another by contracting, they could expect that their contracts would be upheld and not freely violated. But those are not great functions, and even in 19th century America, many state governments or local governments did other tasks as well. They always involved themselves to some extent in the sorts of things that we saw in my discussion of prohibitionism. They enforced at the local level some kind of moral rules, going all the way back to the New England states where people had established a theocracy in the early 17th century and enforced very strict rules about going to church and not doing anything for enjoyment on Sunday and things of that sort. And to some extent, the New Englanders carried their spirit forward in American history, and many of the progressives were the heirs of those old strict New England theocrats. And the progressives also believed, in many cases, in enforcing their view of personal morality on everyone by law. But at the same time, a great many Americans did not accept that kind of regulation of personal life, at least when it went beyond the bounds of normal bourgeois respectability. Now, before I start talking about the war, I want to emphasize that two of the institutions created just before the war began were completely essential to the way that the United States government organized its war program. One of them was the change of the Constitution to permit the federal government to collect income tax, because that kind of taxation allowed the government to gain much more revenue than it could ever have got by excise taxes, sales taxes, taxes on products, or especially imported products, which were subject to the tariff. Government did impose more of those kinds of taxes during World War I, but there was a limit on how much could be obtained from excise taxes and tariffs. But the income tax allowed the government to get much more money from taxes, and that was critical in fighting the war, because the war involved an enormous expense, 10 times more expense than the war between the states. The other important institution created just before the war began was the Federal Reserve System. And because the Federal Reserve System, through its policies, could, in effect, create money out of nothing, it was also an immensely useful instrument to help the government pay for a vast war program. And although the government during World War I did not just print paper money as it had during the war between the states, it did indirectly accomplish the same end by the way it regulated the commercial banks. And I'll describe in a little while how it went about that. Now, of course, the war began in Europe in August 1914, and at that time the Americans had no stake in the war at all, no involvement, no alliances with either of the warring parties, no reason to become involved. And indeed, the great majority of Americans desired very much to stand apart from that war. They could not see any reason whatever for America to become involved. They did not see any American interest at stake. They did not see any necessity of involving the United States. This seemed like a war between great European powers or dynasties, no different from many, many previous European wars, and a long American tradition going back to the time of Jefferson and Washington had always urged Americans to stay free of involvement in Europe's quarrels, because they were endless and they would always drag us to our destruction. Now, for the most part, in the 19th century, the American government followed that advice. Not always, and especially when the United States was spreading across the North American continent, it took the opportunity to go to war with Mexico. And earlier in the century, it was repeatedly attempting to invade Canada and take that away from the British. But those efforts always failed also. And most of the time, the American government did keep itself free of engagement in anything connected with European wars. Now, we know that at the very end of the 19th century, the Americans began, some of them began to take a more ambitious view of America's place in the world. they began to support what they called the large policy. They realized that America had become, because of its great economic development, potentially the most powerful nation on earth. I say potentially because its armed forces were very, very small. It was not ready to go to war with any important power, but it could have made itself ready because it had a great economy, an economy that by the year 1913 produced more industrial goods than Great Britain, France, and Germany all combined. So America had become a great industrial power, but it was not transforming that industrial power into military power. It did not require any great military mobilization to defeat Spain. Spain was a very weak country by 1998, easily defeated even by the Americans. So the supporters of the large policy were responsible for the war against Spain and for taking the Philippines and making them an American colony, for taking Cuba and making it a kind of protectorate, and taking Puerto Rico and some other smaller territories from Spain. But that did not seem as if it was necessarily the beginning of a permanently interventionist foreign policy. Many people hoped it would be an aberration, an anomaly. They hoped that would not be repeated. Some even formed a group called the Anti-Imperialist League to publicize their opposition to America's becoming an imperial power like the leading powers of Europe. So that's where we stood when the war began in Europe in 1914. Great desire for neutrality, and President Wilson immediately announced that we were neutral and we would remain neutral, and he urged all of his fellow Americans to be neutral in thought and deed. Now, of course, some of them could not very easily be neutral because, for example, some of them had only recently come from Germany or Austria, and perhaps it was very natural for them to sympathize with those countries. Others had come from countries on the other side. There were many Irish in America, and of course, anything the British were for, they were against. So the fact that we had many Germans and many Irish people in the United States had some importance for influencing public opinion, but it never resulted in any serious political pressure for the United States to go to war on one side or another. There was one small group, however, that favored, almost from the beginning, American involvement in the war. And they seem to have done so for two reasons, which in their minds probably were almost the same reason. One reason was that they had many close connections with Britain. They had close economic ties. They did a lot of business. Some of them had places of business in both England and the United States, especially bankers such as the great banker J.P. Morgan. He was probably the leading figure in this group, not only the richest, but very, very influential, because he was able to bring along many other people by using his great wealth and influence. But these people had many ties of business and of personal friendship and association with Great Britain. So they immediately favored the British. And as the war went on, these people in the Morgan circle also entered into relationships to help the allies in their war effort by raising money for them and lending that money, especially to the British, but also to the French, or by acting as agents for them when the allies purchase war materials in the United States. And they immediately began to do that. The United States had been in a mild recession in the year 1914, but as the European orders for American products began to come in, American exports doubled in the next 2 years. So America grew very rapidly in 1915 and 1916, and it seemed that Americans were prospering because of the bloodshed in Europe. Meanwhile, of course, the Europeans were slaughtering one another by the millions. By that time, in a war that had almost completely stalemated in France, and in which the two sides simply made gigantic attacks on one another with very little to show for it. Hardly ever did they move the opposing side more than a few kilometers, if that. So it was a kind of meat grinder in which men were fed as the meat and ground up into human garbage. The generals were very slow in that war to learn that there was something wrong with their tactics, that somehow these tactics were not succeeding. They were only getting a great many men killed and wasting a great deal of munitions. I think perhaps they never did learn. The entire world seems to be a monument to stupidity in every way. But as that was going on, the Morgan Circle began to influence public opinion more and more. And it began to influence President Wilson, which was the most important thing. Wilson probably had some sympathies toward the British in the beginning, but he did not reveal those sympathies, and he does seem to have acted with fair neutrality early in the war. But particularly after some ships were sunk by German submarines with loss of American lives, Wilson was upset, and other Americans were upset because they believed that those U-boat attacks were a violation of the American right to travel as neutrals during wartime. This was an extraordinary claim that they were making, because the Lusitania, for example, the most famous of such ships sunk by the Germans, was a British ship that actually had on board not only American passengers, but also a great many munitions, boxes of ammunition. And so the Germans had every right under the laws of war to sink that ship, and the Americans were simply fools to be on board it. But at the time, the British denied that the ship was carrying munitions, and the British proved to be extremely good at propaganda, both in that war and in the next one. The British must have thought the Americans were like children, so easily led by the nose, easily tricked by British propaganda. And the British were masterful. Of course, the Germans were trying to use propaganda at the same time. They were trying to influence American public opinion, but they did not have equal success, ever. So the British were gradually working to turn American public opinion in favor of the Allies and against the Central Powers. And President Wilson came to share that sympathy. So as public opinion changed, the authorities began to think they should do something to prepare the United States to participate in the war, or perhaps just to defend itself better in the Atlantic, if nothing else. The American Navy was second rate. It was not the British Navy, but it was a respectable Navy. But we had very few soldiers in our army, not even 200,000 soldiers in the American Army. So this was of no consequence. The European armies had millions of men in each of the major countries' armies. So the United States could not have any military effect by its army, even if it sent every man to France. So it realized that if it were going to become a more effective military power, it needed to bring more men into the army. But there was great public resistance to doing so. Many people began to see through the trick that was being played on them. They began to say, if you get ready for war, then pretty soon you'll find yourself tempted to go to war. So let's not even go down that road. Let's avoid that. Let's remain strictly neutral. But the forces favoring war gradually began to have a greater influence in politics and in public opinion. Now, some of these moves to prepare did result in surveys of American industry to find out which industries could be converted to war purposes. They did result in some important legislation enacted in 1916, giving the President of the United States power, on the one hand, to order military supplies from any factory and obtain them at a price fixed by him. They didn't have to pay a market price if they thought it was too high. They could pay whatever they felt like. And if the manufacturer did not want to sell, the government was given the power to take control of his plant and operate it as they ordered. So this was a great power, which was later used many times after America did enter the war. Another act passed by Congress in 1916 gave the president the power to take over any system of transportation. And in the beginning, this law was probably passed because America had been having little border fights with the Mexicans during the Mexican Revolution. Sometimes the Mexican revolutionaries or bandits would just cross the border into the United States and make raids on small towns and then escape back into Mexico. And so the American army was sent down to the border with Mexico to raid into Mexico and chase down Pancho Villa and other Mexican bandits that were causing trouble. When they were doing that, they discovered that they had trouble getting railroad service to carry troops and supplies to the border. So the law was probably passed not thinking of the government's taking over the railroads of America in a big war, but just taking over one or two railroads to bring troops and supplies down into Texas when they were desired. But there the law stood, and that's the way law often works. Once a law is passed, once the government is given a new power, then it's there to be used for purposes that may never have been imagined at the time that law was created. So many laws have worked that way. So beware what laws you pass, what powers you give the government. You never know how the government of the future will use those powers. In 1916, the first of the important war measures was taken, even though the United States had not yet entered the war. That is one that appears in the upper left-hand box of my chart here. I'm going to be using this to summarize a lot of things done during three great national emergencies of the first half of the 20th century and the two wars and the Great Depression. The shipping board was created by a law in September 1916, But it was created because after the war began in Europe, shipping became very scarce for carrying goods across the oceans. Many German and Austrian ships were simply brought back into their ports and unable to get out because the British Navy would prevent them. The ships of Great Britain were being used for war purposes, for Britain's own purposes, and so not much British shipping was available to Americans any longer. And the British in those days had the largest merchant marine in the world, so normally Americans would have shipped most of their exported goods on British ships. But now those ships had become very scarce, and so shipping rates, the costs of carrying goods by ocean transport, had risen sometimes 6 or 7 or 8 times higher than they had been in 1914. Now, that made it almost impossible for goods to be profitably exported or imported by Americans. And so naturally, the people in the export-import business were quite unhappy about that development. In the circumstances, it was a natural development in the market. There was a greater demand for shipping services and a reduced supply of shipping services. So the natural result in the market was that the prices rose greatly. Often what we find is when natural market increases occur in prices, people are so unhappy that their first thought is to get the government to somehow intervene and do something about it, to fix prices perhaps, to keep them from being so high. And that is exactly what many Americans began to lobby for in 1916. They said, you know, we need the government to put some kind of control on the price of shipping services. They realized there was a lot of money to be made in the American foreign trade. There was great demand for American products in the world, even from the European powers. But they had to be able to get the goods to the purchasers at reasonable prices. So in 1916, Congress, after much political debate and argument on both sides, finally passed the Shipping Act and created something called the U.S. Shipping Board, authorizing that board to control the rates charged by ocean shippers and authorizing it to create a subsidiary, a corporation, which it created the following year and called the Emergency Fleet Corporation. And the Emergency Fleet Corporation was empowered to actually create an American merchant fleet by building new ships and operating those ships itself. So what this act did was put the American government into the shipping business. So it would operate shipping lines itself, and it would also regulate the rates charged by private shipping lines. This didn't completely take over private industry in ocean shipping, but it moved strongly in that direction. And later, in 1917 and 18, Congress gave new powers to the shipping board, and the result was a complete takeover and control of ocean shipping for all but the very smallest ships. So this was a major departure. Now, when the United States finally got around to entering the war in April 1917, it was still quite unprepared to exert any military strength in France or anywhere else. So it was going to take a long time to build up the American army and to strengthen the American Navy. And the Americans began to plan for that buildup, but it necessarily required a lot of time. In retrospect, it's perhaps amazing they accomplished as much as they did during the 19 months that the United States was involved as a belligerent in this war. But during the year 1917, they were still in the preparation stage in almost every respect. Now, one thing they did was to take over the railroad industry of the United States at the end of 1917. When the government began to place orders for war materials and to ship munitions to Europe, it was not very intelligent about how it made those arrangements. It shipped almost all of those products from the major ports in the Northeast, New York especially, also Philadelphia, Baltimore, Boston, the big American port cities in the Northeast. Well, pretty soon, those ports were so busy they couldn't accommodate all the ships that were trying to unload and load materials. So many ships were just waiting in the harbors, wasting time. That was a problem. What to do about that? Another problem contributing to this congestion was that when all the supplies came from the factories and other sources of supply for war materials, they all had to travel over the railroads leading into those cities, into New York, into Philadelphia, and so forth. Well, soon those rail lines had all the traffic they could accommodate. And so the trains were standing by, waiting to proceed, but having to wait until other trains unloaded their cargoes and cleared the tracks. So the rail system, as well as the ocean shipping ports, were all getting clogged up. And the war supply effort was coming to a halt almost. And this became such a problem that the government first took over the railroads and tried to impose government planning to clear the traffic and get the trains through quicker with their goods, and also took other measures to speed the movement of ships in and out of the harbors. And I'll mention one later because it had to do with the control of coal. Some of the ships were stalled because they had no coal for fuel, and that was also the product of other government planning. So what we have here very early is government takeovers of transportation systems, both in ocean shipping and in the railroads. That meant that when Americans wanted to use the railroads or the ships for their own purposes, unrelated to war, they were competing with the government. And, of course, the government always gave itself priority. So that if trains were carrying troops, if they were carrying military materials, then ordinary shippers had to simply wait until they could have an opportunity to send their goods. So this had an effect on the operation of the whole economy because it made the transportation system less efficient and the division of labor that would have operated was more difficult. Okay. Now, even before the declaration of war, the military authorities had convinced the president that we must not rely on voluntary enlistment of soldiers, that we would have to do what all the great powers were doing, draft soldiers, force men to serve in the armed forces. Now, if you recall, during the war between the states, men were drafted on both sides. But that draft was extremely unpopular. In many cities, it led to riots. And in some cases, the army had to go in and shoot down men on the streets, as it did in New York, to suppress the rioters. who were rioting because the government was trying to draft them into the army. So our experience with the draft was not a happy one. Many Americans had never believed the draft was an American institution to begin with. It was, they always said, a Prussian thing. It was the kind of thing we expect from autocracies, but not from a free society. So they were very much against it. And of course, the men who are drafted are always against the draft, no matter where it's imposed. No one likes to be made into a common soldier, to be treated like dirt and ordered about and made to live in a mud hole and possibly to be killed. So the draftees never liked the draft. I can speak from some personal experience, not because I was drafted, I was not, but because during a war in Vietnam in which I had great personal familiarity, the Americans were still drafting men, and it was probably the most unpopular thing that ever happened to that generation. They hated it, and they mounted great protests against it and against the war that led to it. And eventually that pressure helped to bring the American engagement in Vietnam to an end. In the First World War, however, the government was smarter than it had been during the war between the states. One thing that was especially unpleasant about the old draft during the Civil War was that the Army was in charge of operating it. So they would send out soldiers, and if men didn't report as ordered, they would simply go to the men's homes with their rifles and force people at bayonet point to come with them and almost kidnap them into service in the Army. So that was the worst way to operate the draft. During World War I, they had a clever idea. They said, let's put civilians in charge. Instead of having the soldiers go around and drag men away to be in the army, we will have thousands of local committees. Each town, each neighborhood in a city will have its own draft board. And the members of this draft board will be local citizens who will volunteer to do this service. And, of course, the government will give them the general rules for the operation of the system of conscription, but they will have some discretion in how they operate locally. They'll be able to decide, for example, which men to exempt, to release from the requirement for service. For various reasons, all sorts of reasons. And in practice, these reasons often involved local prejudices of one kind or another, whether it was prejudice against black men in the South or prejudice against Irish men in Massachusetts or whatever the local prejudice happened to be, these local draft boards would tend to express it in their decisions about whom to exempt from the draft. That's always the way any kind of local petty government power operates. It's invariably a mechanism for people to help their friends and hurt their enemies. And the draft was no exception to that rule. But the draft was furiously resisted when the president proposed it in April 1917. And it was debated in Congress for weeks. And many people expected that if the draft were put into operation, there would be great riots and bloodshed and all the things that had happened during the war between the states. Those things did not happen, however. When the registration day occurred at the beginning of June, 10 million men dutifully walked in voluntarily and registered as eligible for the draft or potentially eligible. Later on, the draft boards called names from those that had registered, and then they made their exemptions at that point. But there was no great rioting or bloodshed. And one reason was that not only did the civilians administer the draft, but there were very, very severe penalties, not only for resisting. Resisting could get you 1 year in prison, but especially for obstructing the operation of the draft system. If I just went out on the street, for example, and gave a speech saying the draft is un-American, it's wrong, we should not have a draft, the government might charge me with a crime, and I might be penalized by as much as 20 years in prison and a fine of $10,000. These are enormous penalties. And later on, because some people did attempt to obstruct the draft or did speak against it, the government did penalize them. Some important people were put in prison for speaking against the draft. During World War I, the Americans completely lost their composure. Many of them became hysterically patriotic in the worst way. They began to physically attack anyone who seemed not only to be obstructing the war effort, but even someone who was not working hard enough for it. These people were called slackers, people who were holding back their efforts, not giving 100% support to the war. And so not only did the government penalize people heavily for obstructing its military mobilization system, but people's neighbors or friends might also become enemies, and in some cases men were even killed, especially the Germans who were living here at the time, and German Americans. Some of these people had been born in America, but they were of German ancestry, and so they became the objects of attack as well, even murder in some cases. So this was a very unreasonable period in the United States, a period of more than 2 years, because it didn't end at the end of the war. The hysterical patriotism continued at the end of the war in the form of what is known as the Red Scare, fear of Bolsheviks and of anarchists. And hundreds of people were deported, sent away from the United States because they were believed to be anarchists or Bolsheviks. These fears were entirely exaggerated. There were very few Bolsheviks or anarchists in the United States, and they posed no real threat at all to the government's control here. But people became very fearful and hyper-patriotic in 1917, 18, and 19 in the United States. It was probably the worst such episode in our entire history. So we had military conscription. It proved to be effective despite some opposition, and eventually 2.8 million men were drafted. 2.8 million. That equaled approximately 70% of all the men in the American Army. The Army was built up to a strength of approximately 4 million men by the end of the war, and 2.8 million were draftees. These men were paid very little. On average, they were paid only a little more than $1 per day. And eventually, when they did arrive in Europe in large numbers at the early in 1918 and began to engage in actual battles, many of them were killed, and many others died of disease. So that eventually, about 119,000 American soldiers died, and about twice that many were wounded. So these look like small casualties compared to the casualties of the Germans or Austrians or French, British, Russians. But they were probably serious to the people involved. And once again, this was an odd war for Americans. Remember, we really have no stake here. In a way, this is a war we've been tricked into. So we have this big intervention in the labor market, withdrawing millions of men. Approximately 16% of the male labor force was taken away by the army. So that meant labor was quite scarce. So this created a good opportunity for labor unions to bargain more strongly, and they were having many strikes in 1917, and when men went on strike, of course, that threatened the war program, because if they're not working, they're not producing war material. So the government then undertook to create a mediation board, a war labor policies board, and other interventions to settle the labor disputes. And it encouraged unions. Never before had the federal government in the United States actually encouraged unions. It had always been either neutral or hostile toward labor unions. Now, for the first time, it was on their side, and it encouraged employers to give them liberal settlements, raise their wages, give them good working terms so they'll stay on the job and keep creating war materials. So this was a new departure. One of the slogans that the Americans used during the war was the slogan, "Wheat will win the war." Now that seems silly. And how can wheat win a war? Presumably you need weapons and ammunition and the machinery of war to win a war. But there was something to it. Before the United States entered the war in 1917, great shipments of food were being sent to France and Belgium and Great Britain. And so wheat was an important supply for the Allies and for the Belgians, who were suffering from occupation by the Germans of that part of Europe. So wheat had been an important war supply, but of course the troops have to be supplied too, and the civilians who are working to produce war supplies, they have to eat. So in a way, wheat was a war material of some importance. But all food was getting scarcer because of the great demands being placed from exports as well as from domestic demand. So prices were rising, and food was sometimes being directed into channels that did not satisfy the government. It was not going where the government thought it would do the most good for the war program. So the government passed legislation in 1917 in the autumn to give itself a high degree of control over industries involved in food distribution and producing supplies to create food or to create feed for animals. In that war, of course, animals were still used as power sources, even by the armies. So there were many horses to be fed and mules. And so feed for animals was a kind of war supply also. And the government took over the ability to insist that every dealer in food be licensed by the government. And every person with a license had to obey various regulations the government placed on them. If they did not, their license could be taken away, and then they were no longer able to be in that business. So the government, it was in a position to insist that everyone conduct his business in food or feed or fertilizer or related machinery in the way the government wanted the business conducted. One thing they did was to issue priorities, to say certain needs must be satisfied before other needs are supplied. And these priorities went all the way down to the local level. In fact, they became absurdly tyrannical. Every county in the United States has approximately 3,000 counties. That's a small local unit of government. And every county had a food administrator, a subordinate of the agency called the U.S. Food Administration. And these local food administrators could make rules for when people ate each kind of food. So they would issue orders saying, on Monday, eat no wheat. On Tuesday, eat no meat. On Wednesday, eat no pork at dinner. You know, very, very silly, very detailed rules about how much to eat of meat or of a certain kind of meat or of wheat or other grains used as human food. They issued rules for how much sugar you should put in your coffee. Now you might suspect that this kind of rule would be almost impossible to enforce. How are you going to make sure that everybody who's not supposed to eat any meat on Tuesday eats no meat? Well, the way you do it is the way that all tyrannies enforce rules. They make everybody an informant. All of these people who were turning into super patriots became informants on their neighbors. And so they would look in the window and say, aha, Mr. Smith is eating meat on Tuesday, even though the regulation says absolutely forbidden. And then they would report Mr. Smith to the local food administrator. And he might bring in Mr. Smith to give an explanation to the authorities and intimidate Mr. Smith and make an example of him and lead his neighbors to be aware that he was violating the government's rules. And then others would come forth to be unfriendly. So this whole system of having every citizen watch every other citizen, the worst kind of a Stalinistic regulation, was part of the government's World War I food regulation. And it was part of other regulations as well. In that atmosphere, you could get away with such silly and tyrannical operations by government agencies. So we had food controls, but that was certainly not everything. Industry was never nationalized in general, as the railroads or the ocean ships were, but industry could be nationalized piecemeal, one factory at a time. The army could issue a requisition, an order, which the factory owner had to supply at the price offered. And if he didn't voluntarily agree, the army could simply take over control of the factory. The army did that on hundreds of occasions. The Navy did similar things. Other government agencies also requisitioned and made mandatory orders. The Railroad Administration, the government operated. Other government agencies that needed to accumulate supplies also made mandatory requisitions. So you could take over any plant you decided you needed, but in general, American industry was left in private hands, and people continue to operate them as best they could in the circumstances. But the government did organize many boards to establish priorities for orders industry would fill. And so there were about 80 of these different committees established. Say one committee was in charge of iron and steel. One was in charge of non-ferrous metals, such as copper and zinc. Another committee was in charge of leather. Another was in charge of cotton textiles, and so forth. And these committees established priorities, and they issued them to those who wanted to obtain goods. So if I wanted to obtain some steel for my business, to place an order with a steel manufacturer, I had to get a priority rating. And so the Iron and Steel Committee would issue me a priority. It might be priority A, which was very high, or B, or C. Now, before that iron and steel manufacturer could fill any orders with priority B or C, he had to fill all the orders with priority A. So this was a way of assigning demanders priority according to what the government thought was most important in serving the purposes of its war program. And these priorities acted as a kind of rationing device in addition to money. Even though I had a priority A and I got high on the list to obtain goods, I still had to pay, of course. So now there were two forms of currency: the money price and the priority rating attached to orders for industrial goods. And so this system was created and refined in 1918, and it became the means by which government directed products into industries it favored for war purposes and away from industries it did not value highly for war purposes. A man named Bernard Baruch was placed in charge of the War Industries Board, and this board was the overall administrator of the priority system and of other government controls. Early in 1918, the president gave new powers to the War Industries Board, and it became quite powerful. Some people described Baruch as an industrial czar, as if he were personally telling people what to do in industry, and his powers were never quite that great, nor did he exercise them like a czar, not single-handedly, but he did have great power nevertheless, and the government had some success in directing industrial goods toward its favored purposes by this device. So we have the War Industries Board allocating materials through priorities. The War Industries Board also had a committee to fix prices. This was not under Baruch's control, but it was a committee that reported directly to the President of the United States, because price fixing was a very sensitive matter. Depending on where the price was fixed, a producer might have profits or losses. So people had a vital interest in not having their prices set in a way that made their business unprofitable. And the president did not want to make enemies unless he had to make them. So he had the price-fixing committee report directly to him. Now, this was not a committee that tried to restrain overall inflation. It was not an attempt to control prices in general. It was a committee that tried to control only certain commodity prices. Eventually, not even 100, but they were very important ones. And if you looked at the price-controlled commodities, you might be puzzled. You might think, well, why this collection? Why did we have copper? Yes, you can understand that, because copper is important for making shell casings for artillery shells and rifle cartridges. That's an important war material. But why leather? Why burlap? This material for making bagging. Why certain chemicals? Why lumber? But it turned out that there was something that every one of these price-controlled commodities had in common with every other. Either directly or indirectly, each of these commodities was one for which the government itself was placing great demands in order to carry out its war program. So it had a vital interest in holding down the government's money cost of obtaining war supplies. Remember, everything it gets for war, it has to pay for, unless it simply goes out and conscripts it, as it conscripted men for the army. But the government was never in a position where it could simply conscript everything. That would probably have led Americans to rise up and resist the government. Certainly, the men who ran the great American industries were powerful men. They could not be treated like ordinary soldiers in the army. So one had to be careful how powerful men were treated. One didn't simply impose an unpopular price on politically powerful people unless it was absolutely necessary. So the government controlled only certain prices. Even then, it negotiated with the sellers. It tried to get them to agree voluntarily to all of its wishes. And when it couldn't get them to agree voluntarily, it would attack their patriotism and say, "Don't you remember? Our boys are over there dying in the trenches in France. The least you can do is provide the government with leather at a reasonable price." Sometimes beating with the stick of patriotism was effective. And when that was not effective, the government could make other threats. It could, for example, threaten that they would get no railroad services because it now controlled the railroads. And that could, of course, bring almost any business to a halt if it could not use railroads to bring in supplies or send out its products to market. So it could use threats, these so-called indirect sanctions, where it's not like an ordinary legal penalty where someone is assessed a fine or sent to prison, but it's a de facto way of punishing someone with an effective threat made by controlling some part of the economy. So the government became masterful at using indirect sanctions, and it used them later in the Second World War, and then also later, sometimes even during periods of not war, but some other kind of emergency, or what the government believed to be an emergency. So now we have industrial controls. I've said again and again, the government needed huge amounts of money to fight the war. So it raised taxes enormously. When the income tax was first created in 1913, 98% of people paid no income tax. Only very high-income people had to pay income tax. And they never had to pay very much as a percentage. The highest percentage of the income tax rates in 1913 was 7%. Well, that doesn't seem like much to us modern people. Most of us ordinary people pay far greater percentages of tax than that, and sometimes much greater. But During the war, the government immediately raised the income tax rates so that even people with much lower incomes now had to pay tax, and the percentage they had to pay was much greater. At the top end of the scale, the top rate became 77% income tax rate at the margin. So the top marginal rate was increased 11 times between 1913 and 1917. So this actually was a kind of confirmation of those who had opposed the income tax. The supporters of the income tax said, "Don't worry, it's just a tax on the rich, and besides, it's not very much." And the opponents said, "Yes, now it's only the rich, and now it's not very much, but what about later?" And they were right. It turned out to be one of those slippery slopes that the government slipped down very quickly in 1917 and 18 to imposing very heavy taxes. New excise taxes were placed on many goods, inheritance taxes. Taxes on corporation income were raised. Additional taxes were placed on corporations so that besides the regular corporate income tax, they had to pay tax on what was called excess profits. And so corporations were paying huge amounts of money to the government during the war. Sometimes people look at the war and they think, "Oh, the capitalists were getting rich." But that's deceptive because, first of all, because of the government's financing of the war through the creation of new money, the value of the dollar fell by 50% between 1915 and 1920. During that five-year period, the money supply of the United States doubled. It doubled, and just as the classical quantity theory of money predicts, the value of the dollar's purchasing power fell by exactly one half. Twice as much money, dollars half as valuable. It worked perfectly in that case. So it appeared sometimes that businesses were very profitable because they were making more money than they had made in 1914. But the money was not so valuable anymore. And on top of that, they had to pay very high taxes. So the prosperity that some people thought was occurring during the war was an illusion. It was not real. And we can see that if we take the whole national product, take away the government's part of national product, and look only at the private part of national product, and then adjust it for inflation. And when we do that, we find that the real private product of the American economy fell by 6% in 1917, and again by another 6% in 1918. So this was actually not a case of free lunch. It was not that we could have guns and butter at the same time. It's that in order to have more guns, we had to have less butter. We had more government goods, fewer private goods. There was no other way it could be because there were not many unemployed resources to bring into production during the war. So it was simply a matter of moving resources out of peacetime uses into wartime uses. The government created a commission to regulate international trade. The motive was to prevent trade from somehow assisting the enemy. So the legislation was called Trading with the Enemy Act. But this legislation included some very sweeping powers. It's very interesting that the Trading with the Enemy Act was never repealed. It has been part of U.S. law ever since it was enacted in 1917. It has been amended several times, changed, but if you look today in the U.S. Code, Trading with the Enemy Act is still part of the United States statutes. Still there, still empowering the president to interfere now, especially with international financial transactions, whenever he declares a national emergency. And all he needs to do to make that declaration is make it. It's entirely up to the president. He doesn't need anyone else's approval or validation. If President Bush declares a national emergency, there is a national emergency, and many laws that apply only during a national emergency then become effective. So many presidents have used these powers since the time of President Wilson. And in fact, even today, the government is operating under a declaration of national emergency related to the U.S. attack on Iraq. So the president has some exceptional powers, some of them powers to interfere with international finance, which he can do in a variety of ways, including a confiscation of bank accounts or other assets. So the government got this extraordinary power in 1917. It also suspended the operation of the gold standard. Before the war, the United States, along with most of the countries of Western Europe, had been operating on a gold standard, a standard in which the national currency was freely redeemable into a specific amount of gold per unit of paper currency. So that if I carried pound sterling banknote into a bank in London in 1913 and asked for gold, I could get some gold coins in exchange for it. The same thing applied in the United States. If I took a Federal Reserve note in 1915, after they were being circulated, into a commercial bank and ask for gold, I would receive gold coins or a gold account with gold bullion in it. So gold and paper currency circulated at fixed exchange rates, and people always knew that they could rely on the purchasing power of paper currency under the gold standard because the government had no way to suddenly increase the amount of gold it held to make these redemptions when people demanded them. So it restrained the government's monetary authorities from issuing directly or indirectly large amounts of paper currency. Without the gold standard, there was nothing to restrict the government. And the Federal Reserve System then made itself a kind of a servant of the United States Treasury. And what it did was to make very low interest rates on loans the Federal Reserve banks made to the commercial banks. The commercial banks could then borrow money very cheaply from the Federal Reserve Bank and then invest that money. They could, for example, invest it in United States bonds, and they did. Millions of dollars were spent in that way because the bonds paid a higher rate of interest than the banks paid the Federal Reserve System for the loans. Think of that. That's like a money machine. Borrow as much as you can from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York at 3%, and use that money to buy a United States bond that will yield 4%. Every dollar at no risk whatsoever means 1% clear profit. Well, of course, the incentive was to borrow as much as possible and reinvest that money, either in U.S. government bonds or sometimes in the debt notes of private businesses that wanted to borrow from banks. So credit became very easy, very cheap, very abundant during the war because the government wanted a lot of credit available, a lot of loanable funds available in the banking system so that people would use some of them to purchase government bonds. And that would give the government money to spend for its war program. So the government was not exactly printing money, but indirectly it was achieving the same objective as if it had just printed new paper money. Now, it could do this and get away with it because there was no gold standard. People couldn't any longer escape by exporting their dollars or by exporting their gold, because to do that, they had to have a license from the United States Treasury. The Trading with the Enemy Act gave the president, and that is the U.S. Treasury, this power to regulate all these international financial dealings, and they did that. They also seized a lot of enemy property. They seized all kinds of German property that was held in the United States, bank accounts, ships, you name it. They just snatched everything they could. And this was extraordinary because, after all, Herr Schmidt from Hamburg was not personally at war with the United States. The government of the German Empire was at war with the United States. In the 19th century, governments would make war and not penalize private individuals. During the Franco-Prussian War, German banks paid interest to holders of French bonds, and vice versa. The fact that the German government and the French government were at war did not have any effect on private business obligations. But the 20th century, among its crimes, dragged everybody into the wars that governments started, so that no longer could one protect his property rights at all. If you were the citizen of an enemy power, then you became also fair game to be penalized and plundered. And all governments eventually did this in every way they could. It's another example of the fact that governments are warrior bands that plunder whoever they can, whenever they can. What they can get away with, that they will do. So during wartime, they could get away with violating property rights of enemy civilians, and they did so. They could get away with violating property rights of their own citizens to some extent, and they did that too. So there's always a contest in society between the rulers who want more power and more control of the society's resources and the others who are resisting, more or less, the government's seizure of more power and property. War is always the best time for the state to expand its powers, because during war, people become fearful, they reduce their resistance to the government's increased power, they actually try to cooperate with it in many ways, they take sides with it as if it were their friend. They treat the institution that is normally their enemy, suddenly it becomes their friend in wartime. Just as the sheep, when they are attacked by the wolf, suddenly side with the shepherd. Suddenly the shepherd is their friend. Normally the shepherd is the one who decides whether to shear them or slaughter them. But when the wolf attacks, the shepherd is the friend. Governments always want to represent themselves as the shepherd of us sheep. They always want us to believe that they protect us from all the evils, all the wolves, all the harms that might come to us. But the interests of the sheep are not the same as the interests of the shepherd. The shepherd has his own interests. And we are wise to understand that relationship and not to confuse us with our rulers. War is, it was said by one American, Randolph Bourne, the health of the state. So that has become a much remembered slogan by a few of us. Whenever the government proposes going to war or goes to war, we know we're in trouble. We know our liberties are in danger. Our property is in danger. Our rights and our lives are in danger. War is the health of the state. No matter how much the shepherd has an interest in protecting us to keep away the wolf. Well, that should be a good place to stop for today. We'll start again tomorrow.